9.5 minutes past 8 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine this morning, and for the rest of the week, for that matter. Well, if I told you that 100,000 Americans die each year from medical mistakes, would that surprise you? Our healthcare system seemingly has some serious problems, and there are some questions out there. Why is it that with some of the most skilled physicians in the world, we have so many patients dying each year from medical errors? Why has there been a meteoric rise in the cost of healthcare without a significant rise in life expectancy? Why does our care cost more per capita than any of the other countries in the developed world, yet we have some of the worst health statistics? Well, those are all important questions, and for answers, one of the places we can look is a new book published by Bloomsburg. It's called Overtreated, Why Too Much Medicine is Making Us Sicker and Poorer. And we are fortunate to have the author of that book with us by telephone this hour to talk about the state of American medicine and why we're in such tough shape. Please welcome with me Shannon Brownlee, an award-winning journalist, a senior fellow at the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C., and the author of the book Overtreated, Why Too Much Medicine is Making Us Sicker and Poorer, published by Bloomsbury Press. Good morning. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Hi, John. It's my pleasure.
Actually, what I'd like to do is I'd like to read something from the introduction to your book, if I can find the page, which I just had marked and then lost it. You go through in the introduction to your book the common wisdom about how what is wrong with our health system in the United States, and there are a lot of people who say, well, it's too much administration, it's malpractice insurance, it's the profits taken out of the system by greedy health insurance corporations, and so forth. But your conclusion is that we're actually, the biggest problem is that we're actually paying for a lot of medical procedures that are completely unnecessary and don't help to make us healthier. Explain that.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying, is that there's an enormous amount of what's called over-treatment or unnecessary care. And what we know in this country from looking at different parts of the country is that people who have similar levels of illness, similar kinds of illnesses, get very, very different care in different parts of the country. In some places, they get a lot more care. They get a lot more stuff happening to them in the hospital. And in other places, they get less. And that would be fine if the places that were delivering more care were actually having better outcomes. Patients were actually getting better from all that extra treatment, but that's not what's happening. They are not getting better care. They're actually, in some cases, getting worse care, and they're not having better outcomes. So what that tells you is an enormous amount of the care that's being delivered really isn't contributing to health. It is contributing, however, to the high cost of our care.
I have to admit that I felt rather ironic. I was reading your book yesterday as I was sitting in the waiting room at my doctor's office waiting for my annual physical, and it gave me pause before I went into the examining room, and I have to say I probably asked more questions than I normally would, although I have a terrific doctor, but it really makes you think about the fact that hospitals have to make money, and people with insurance are kind of like profit centers for the medical establishment.
Yes, they are. And, you know, I don't think for a second that all the hospitals and doctors out there are rubbing their hands together saying, ha, 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 how can we bilk patients? How can we, you know, how can we give them all kinds of stuff they don't need in order to make money? That's not what's going on for the most part. This is going on because of the way the system is put together. Physicians are often delivering unnecessary care in hospitals totally unconsciously. And hospitals are pursuing profit because they have to. They're not making huge amounts of money. They're operating on maybe 2 to 6% margins. So they are pursuing profits just in order to stay afloat. And the fundamental problem is we don't pay hospitals and doctors to do better. We pay them to do more. And that's what they do.
Your book is filled with stories of individuals and situations, and some of these are just heartrending. In particular, I was thinking about the case of a 12-year-old boy in Washington, D.C., who died from a brain infection that started out as a rotten tooth. But his mother couldn't find a dentist that took Medicaid, and he ended up dying from this.
That's right, and this is a case of the exact opposite. This is a child who did not get care that he really needed. And this is the tragedy of our system, is that at the same time that it's delivering unnecessary care to patients, it's also not delivering care that's really needed. The uninsured don't have adequate access to the kind of care that they need. And even people who are insured often don't get the care that they really need. Sometimes that care is the kind of simple stuff. I mean, I'll give you an example. If you go into the hospital with a heart attack, the absolute single best way to ensure that you will not have a second heart attack is for you to be given a prescription for either aspirin or a beta blocker. And it's only about half the time that heart attack patients actually get that prescription. So they're being undertreated in a sense because this little simple thing is just falling through the cracks. And I think that's one of the things that's going on, is that we were so busy delivering high volumes of care in many hospitals that the really effective, simple stuff gets forgotten.
800-642-1234 is a toll-free number you can use anywhere to reach us, or 263-1890 is the number to call in Madison. We're talking about the healthcare system in the United States and some things that are wrong with it. And we have with us the author of a new book called Overtreated, Why Too Much Medicine is Making Us Sicker and Poorer. Shannon Brownlee has written this book, and it's published by Bloomsbury. I wanted you to talk a little bit about the situation with the Reading Medical Center, because I think this illustrates what you are talking about unnecessary care.
Well, what Reading Medical Center is, it's a hospital in a small town in Northern California, Reading, California. And this case surfaced about 4 years ago, I believe, where there were a number of doctors at the hospital who were treating patients for heart disease. And they were doing invasive procedures like angioplasty, which can be life-saving in the case of a heart attack. And they were doing cardiovascular surgery, like bypass surgery. And the hospital and the physicians ended up being charged by Medicare, by the federal government, for fraudulent care, for giving an enormous number of patients what appeared to be unnecessary surgeries and procedures. Now, this was going on a scale that has not been seen in any other part of the country. This was really kind of an exceptional case, but it's exceptional only in degree, not in kind, because unnecessary cardiac procedures are going on all the time in many parts of the country.
I was struck in particular, though, by how the Reading case illustrated the way hospitals have to operate given the current economic system that the health community faces. For example, you talked about how they could make a lot of money with heart procedures, and they had attracted some high-profile doctors to their hospital. They were able to build, I don't know, a new hospital wing. There was all sorts of money flowing around, and it became almost an economic imperative. If they wanted the hospital to grow, they had to find some areas that they could make money on to make up for areas where they might lose it. I also was struck by how there are many hospitals in the United States. In fact, most of them are operated by nonprofit corporations, but you still have to make your bottom line. Even if you don't make a profit, you've still got to keep yourself operating. John Hopkins University was quite a contrast. Your description of their emergency room, John Hopkins is in a very poor area of Baltimore. They get a lot of uninsured patients, and so you've got this emergency room, which is in a very old building, doesn't have a lot of space, is pretty crowded. And then practically right next to it, this gorgeous facility that is the Cancer Treatment Center, the Cancer Treatment Center makes the money that they lose on the emergency room.
That's exactly right. And all hospitals do this. And, you know, if I were ever really sick, I'd head straight to Johns Hopkins because it's an extraordinary hospital. But like all hospitals, it needs to subsidize the care, that it needs to subsidize patients who are uninsured or underinsured that it ends up treating, and it loses money on those patients. It needs to subsidize that care by turning around and developing its programs that are very, very profitable. And because of the way we pay for care, we pay Medicare and other insurers pay much better for procedures and surgeries than they do for, say, somebody who comes in with pneumonia and has to be cared for, needs antibiotics, et cetera. The hospital makes more profit on these procedures, and so they want to grow those departments. But growing those departments might not be what the population around them really needs. But by growing those departments, they then are able to sort of attract all kinds of patients into those departments, whether or not the kind of care that they're going to deliver there is absolutely necessary. So, for example, your local hospital in your area may be advertising that they have something called a Da Vinci surgical robot, and they make a big deal about this new wonderful technology, which allows surgeons to do very fine surgery using this sort of, it's sort of like a joystick almost. The robot does a lot of the actual surgery. This is a very, very expensive machine. Doctors are pretty enamored of it, and patients think it must be better care because it's so high-tech, but there really isn't any evidence that the outcomes are any better using the surgical robot. So a lot of medicine gets driven by what is profitable and what is very attractive and what is very high-tech, without really knowing whether or not it's producing better outcomes, but it certainly increases the cost.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have some callers join us to talk about this topic this morning. We're talking about healthcare in the United States and what's wrong with it. And the genesis for the discussion is this new book by Shannon Brownlee called Overtreated, Why Too Much Medicine is Making Us Sicker and Poorer. You can join our discussion. We'll take some phone calls right after we take this break. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Almost 23 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday morning, October 2nd, 2007. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine today. Well, later on this afternoon, I should say, there's a lot being said on the campaign trail these days, and it's not easy separating fact from spin. After 5 on At Issue, Ben Marins talks with communication expert Dick Haven about the campaign trail today and how it compares with the past. That's later on this afternoon here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking with Shannon Brownlee. She's an award-winning journalist whose stories and essays about medicine, health, and healthcare and biotechnology have appeared in a number of publications. She's also a senior fellow at the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C., and is the author of Overtreated, Why Too Much Medicine is Making Us Sicker and Poorer, published by Bloomsbury. We've got some callers who are waiting to join our discussion. Let me give the numbers before we go to the phones. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. In Madison, please use 263-1890, 263-1890. We'll go first to Blair in Watertown. Good morning.
Good morning, John. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Shannon, I have a question for you. I mean, this is a great topic. Glad we're speaking about it, especially kind of in the political arena that we're in right now with this issue being a hot button. I was curious, Shannon, of your opinion about diagnostic imaging. You spoke earlier about some invasive surgeries and how that could be an overtreatment. What is your viewpoint on diagnostic imaging being used more in an early health setting to diagnose these illnesses at an earlier stage to reduce the cost? And also what you think of the Deficit Reduction Act, which was recently passed to kind of cut some of this money to diagnostic imaging. And I'll take my answer off there. Thank you.
Wow, that is a great question. Thank you. Diagnostic imaging, as you may know, is probably the fastest growing cost for Medicare right now. It's going up faster even than the cost of the volume of prescriptions for drugs. And it's not clear that all this extra imaging is actually resulting in better health outcomes. For example, there's been some recent stuff in the news about using CT scanning for lung cancer to screen for lung cancer and treat it early. And the evidence just isn't in that screening and catching it early really makes a difference. And there are a lot of reasons for that that are a little bit complicated, but that the assumption that if, A, you catch it early, you're going to do better may not hold true for many, many diseases, including many cancers. And two, imaging may not be the way that we ought to be going out and looking for things. And so there's this huge number of images that are being done. And number three, many of these images use x-rays. CT scans are a lot of x-rays. And increasing numbers of radiologists are beginning to worry that we're exposing people to an awful lot of radiation and that we don't know what the long-term consequences of all that radiation is going to be. Now, that doesn't mean if your doctor says you need a CT scan so I can diagnose, you know, whether or not you've got bleeding in your brain, you should say, no, I don't want a CT scan because I'm worried about radiation. But it is something we need to start thinking about, and it is an enormous reason for costs going up. The Deficit Budget Act, the act that you refer to, which I'm getting all messed up, says it is trying to restrict the use of imaging by doctors in their offices, and this is probably a good idea because many physicians have turned to imaging as a way to kind of keep their incomes up as Medicare reimbursements have fallen. And it's not necessarily clear that all this imaging is really helping patients.
Let's go next to John in Madison. John, good morning. You're on the air.
Yeah. Compared to the European socialized systems, which all the European countries have, we spend twice per capita, and we don't cover 46 million people. That's twice per capita. We're spending $2 to their $1. And if you look at the aggregate of all the parameters that indicate health for the population, we're like 27th. You know, we're 27th, and we're spending twice what all these socialized systems spend. You know, I was just thinking about this the other day. If you lop off the 16% overhead that we have because of this this small healthcare insurance provider redundancy, you're still left with a whopping 35% that needs to be explained. When you look at these European countries, what is the difference in terms of the diagnostic tests they order, the procedures they perform, and the types of surgeries? It seems to me there ought to be a clear indication where the medical business in this country is going awry.
That's a very interesting question. The Europeans and Canadians do indeed have very different systems. They're mostly single-payer systems. Some of them have single-provider systems, which is a slightly different notion. And they generally have better statistics than we do. They also deliver a lower volume of care. They often use diagnostic imaging far less frequently. They use invasive procedures less frequently. And they many of them get the same kinds of results we do, even when you look disease from disease to disease. Now, this is not universally true. For example, breast cancer survival rates in the UK look to be a little bit lower than the US. So what they're doing is they're doing a more efficient job of using their physicians and using their dollars to be able to deliver the same kind of health. You also have to remember that all those uninsured people are not getting the access that they need to care, and that also makes our statistics look worse.
800-642-1234 is the number to call to join our discussion from anywhere you can hear this broadcast. But if you're in Madison, we'd appreciate it if you'd use 263-1890. Let's take a call next from Ann in Milwaukee. Ann, good morning.
Good morning. I'm sorry, I'm on a cell phone. That's all I've got right now. I wanted to bring up the early diagnostic testing also as regards cancer screening. And my understanding that is that there's a lot of testing that's not useful. It's catching pseudo disease cancers, often tiny cancers or non-cancers, atypia type cells that are never going to grow into cancer, and patients are being told that they have to have surgery and sometimes radiation and chemotherapy, and the outcomes for this death rates have not gone down, even though we're catching these tiny precursors. And I wondered if the author has heard about this.
Yes. Thanks very much for that question. And you have really sophisticated listeners in this area. I'm really impressed. Pseudo-disease is exactly the term that's used. It means a little tiny lump that might look like cancer on an image, but in fact we don't really know whether or not it ever would have harmed the person in their lifetime. And it's very clear that we're catching a lot of pseudo-disease with screening for cancer. The assumption that if you catch it early, you will have better mortality, you will have, not better mortality, you have lower mortality, you'll have better survival, simply hasn't been demonstrated. And in fact, there's reason to think that it's not going on in certain cancers. A very good example is prostate cancer. The PSA test, the prostate-specific antigen test, is a very simple blood test, not an imaging test, that indicates that a man may have a little tumor growing in his prostate. The treatment for this is usually surgical removal of the prostate, and the side effects from the treatment are pretty bad. They're impotence and incontinence, or both, and it can last a long time. It can last for the rest of the man's life. So you don't want to go treating people unnecessarily. The problem is we've never really been able to determine whether or not giving many unsymptomatic men the PSA test is actually lowering the mortality rate, and there's some indication that it isn't. Yet it's becoming more and more popular because the assumption is that if you catch it early and small, you're going to have better survival. This is an enormous conundrum, and we have to do the research to find out what really works and what doesn't.
Let's go next to Helen in Madison. Helen, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Yeah, this is a great program. Lots of issues. The first one I want to address is the fact that I get the feeling sometimes that pharmaceutical companies are pushing medications. And whereas one level of blood pressure used to be acceptable, they're now saying, no, it has to be much lower. Therefore, you need medication. And this happened to me recently, and I decided not to take the medication. Is that in your experience?
Yes, this is, and I write about this in the book, that increasingly the pharmaceutical industry has had an enormous influence over how we set or how we determine what is disease and what isn't, what's normal, what's abnormal. And the problem with doing this is a little bit like letting your Lexus dealer tell you, A, what kind of car you should drive, and B, how often you need to buy a new car. We've handed a great deal of the control over medical research and over these kinds of guidelines for physicians to the pharmaceutical industry, and the pharmaceutical industry has a job, and that job is to increase shareholder value and sell more drugs. So this is one of the issues that we really need to address in this country is who is funding the research and who is setting the guidelines. And I argue that we all should be funding the research through federal tax dollars. We need to be funding it ourselves, not leaving it to the pharmaceutical industry. And two, we need to make sure that our medical researchers are really independent, that they are able to give us the best scientific answers possible that aren't tainted by influence from the industry.
In your book, you devote a couple of chapters to pharmaceuticals. You talk about the rise of direct-to-consumer advertising of prescription drugs, and the idea being they weren't selling the drugs; they first had to sell the ailment. Talk a little bit about that, please.
Yeah, there's actually a term for it in the marketing circles. It's called condition branding. What you do is you sell the condition and you sell the remedy for the condition at the same time. And one of the first examples of that was Viagra, which came out in the 1990s. And the condition that it was supposed to be fixing was called erectile dysfunction. And the marketers actually came up with this term as a way of making impotence something that men could talk about, which is a very good idea. I mean, this is something you should be able to talk to your doctor about without embarrassment. But what it did is it also made many men think that the first time that they failed to perform must mean they had, quote, erectile dysfunction. So they branded this condition and then sold the drug. Now we have, now we've seen the evolution of the marketing, and as one marketer put it, erectile dysfunction is old news. Now it's EQ, erectile quality. So now what these new drugs are being sold for is not a bona fide disease. They're being sold as an enhancement.
And you've got teenage males using these drugs.
Yeah. Well, what teenagers need with erectile enhancement is beyond me.
I can't figure this out.
No,
teenagers must be different these days.
That's right. Being a teenager must be very different these days. But this is the real problem with direct-to-consumer advertising, and many physicians are very disturbed by this, is that that when you start selling diseases, you start making people think they're sick all the time. So the latest disease, I think everybody's probably heard of it by now because the ads are all over the place, is something called restless leg syndrome. Now, is everybody now worrying that they have restless leg syndrome? This is a very rare condition, and the drug for it is not something to be taken lightly. But by
I happen to have that condition, by the way.
You do?
Yes, I do, and my doctor doesn't treat me for it. He said the side effect, the drug that they mainly use to treat restless leg syndrome is actually a drug that was first developed to treat Parkinson's disease,
right.
And it has some potentially fairly significant side effects. And I said, no, thank you. I'll just take some ibuprofen when I have a problem.
Well, it sounds like you have a really good doctor
I like my doctor.
You know, who discusses things with you, which is terrific. By the way, Wisconsin is a very interesting state. Wisconsin has a lower rate, for the most part, of overtreatment than a lot of other states. The physicians in your state tend to practice more conservative medicine, and that's a good thing.
Well, all the Badger fans stand up and cheer because we just scored again. let me give the phone numbers again, and we've got a few phone lines that have become vacant, and you can fill them for us at 800-642-1234 or 263-1890. We're talking about over-treatment in the medical community in the United States, and with us by phone is Shannon Brownlee, who's an award-winning journalist and author of the book, Overtreated, Why Too Much Medicine is Making Us Sicker and Poorer. I was intrigued and alarmed and angered, I think, a little bit when I discovered how low the United States has slipped in a number of measures of healthiness. And in some areas, we're behind Cuba, a country that we regularly ridicule as being backward.
Yes, it's really pretty amazing. As a colleague of mine at New America puts it, these countries are countries that ought to be beating us at soccer, not at health care. There are many countries that you would not think would have better health statistics than we do, better infant mortality statistics, better longevity statistics, but they do. And it says that we're not devoting our resources. I mean, we're spending $2.1 trillion on health care. That makes our healthcare industry one of the biggest industries in the entire world. I mean, you know, to give you a sense of the scale, the worldwide market for petroleum is $3 trillion. So we're spending an enormous amount of money, but we're not getting good value for our money. And one of the reasons is I think, that we're not putting those resources into the kinds of public health measures that we should be. We need to be taking care of mothers who have babies, especially poor mothers who are having babies. We need to be taking care of children. We need to be insuring children. It doesn't cost very much to insure a child, but you get a tremendous amount of benefit out of doing that. So we're misspending our dollars, in effect, and part of where we're misspending those dollars is on unnecessary care, and we need to sort of rethink how we spend that money so that we get better value out of each dollar.
We're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we've got some callers who would like to join our discussion. And since I encouraged them to call in, we really should take the calls. And so we will do just exactly that in just a moment. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:40. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just ahead after 9, Newt Gingrich says he won't run for president because the system precludes a middle-class candidate. Candidates Obama and Clinton are even up in their campaign coffers. Edwards and McCain have said they'll accept public funds. After 9 this morning, Kathleen Dunn and her guests discuss the latest in campaign financing. This hour, we're talking about the health system in the United States, and in part at least how that's financed as being one of the problems, but over-treatment being the main focus. The name of the book under discussion is Overtreated, Why Too Much Medicine is Making Us Sicker and Poorer, published by Bloomsbury and written by Shannon Brownlee, who is with us by telephone. And you can be with us by phone, too, at 800-642-1234 or 263-1890. I promised we'd go back to the phones after the break, and I'm keeping my promise. It's Vlado in Milwaukee. You're next. Good morning.
Good morning. Excellent program. Thank you to have me on the air. I'm calling. I have a question. I was wondering if that might be a problem in the United States. At least my experience was that hospitals or doctors, they charge whatever they want from clients without clients have any chance to basically keep the cost down. For example, hello, am I?
Yes. Yep, you're on. Go ahead.
Yes. Okay, I'm sorry. I just didn't. So, for example, like my wife was in hospital and she had some problems associated with the birth, and now we got a bill which was about roughly $30,000, and I was comparing that bill, and there was amounts like $200 sample handling, $2 for aspirin pill, which you can buy 300 aspirins when you go to Walgreens. Etc. It was a lot of different charges, and when I called them and I disputed them, I had no chance to get any money back because they said that's what you have to expect. But I, as a customer, I had no knowledge about aspirin costing $2 per pill. I would have bought it in a store and bring it to the hospital. So I'm wondering if that's the reason why the gentleman called before in Europe is the cost much lower, because the state and the insurance companies, they keep the calls down. Thank you very much.
I just have one question. Before the caller leaves, are you insured?
Why? That's my calling card in Europe. It's the cost much lower.
I think you've got your radio on there, Vlado. You need to turn it off. There's a delay here. Oops, I think we just lost him.
Oh, darn it. Well, if the caller was insured, what's going on in this case is probably this, what we talked about cost shifting, that hospitals are losing money when they take care of the insured who can't pay, and they then transfer some of those costs over to the insured patients and to Medicare. So what you see on your hospital bill is often an indication of how the hospital is trying to recoup its losses. But there's another problem here for the uninsured, which is that some hospitals charge the uninsured the full top price because they say that the uninsured are not part of the insurance pool, and the insurer comes. What happens is insurers come to hospitals and they negotiate prices with the hospital. And what hospitals then do is if you come in and you're uninsured, they then charge you top dollar because you have not negotiated that lower price with them. And you know, there's some real concern that this is a pretty common practice. We don't really know how common it is, but it's true. You look at your bill and you think this is crazy, $2 for an aspirin. But in part, it's a reflection of the fact that the hospital is trying to recoup losses that it incurs by taking care of people who are not insured. The larger question here is whether or not patients, because they're insured and are insulated for the most part from the price of care, are consuming more care than they would if they were actually paying out of pocket. And there's some reason to think that that is the case in certain kinds of care. Like if you go to the doctor for a bruise that you probably would have gotten better for all by yourself because you know that insurance will pay for going to the doctor, that's a kind of unnecessary care that's driven by patients. Most of the overtreatment and most of the unnecessary care is occurring when patients are hospitalized, and most people who are in the hospital are too sick to be demanding care because they don't know how much it costs. They're getting care that's prescribed to them.
Well, and a lot of times, you know, you're laying there in the hospital or in the clinic, and the doctor says, "Well, we're going to do this or that," and you don't, you know, grab your cell phone and call the insurance claims people and say, "Well, will you pay for this?" And I had a recent experience like this myself. I had a it was a simple endoscopy. They needed to look at my esophagus because I was having some problems, and I was scheduled for the morning, and I knew I couldn't drive home. And I said, "Well, listen, I have to be on the radio on the Ideas Network at 4 o'clock this afternoon. So can we hurry up here?" And he said, "Oh, well, in that case, I'm going to have a general anesthesia because you'll recover from that faster, and then you won't be you won't sound crazy when you're on the radio." And I said, "Well, most people wouldn't be able to tell the difference anyway." But as it turned out, I got a almost a $500 bill because my insurance company said, "Well, no, that wasn't necessary in your case." And at the time, I didn't think anything of it because the I trusted the doctor, and he wasn't checking with the insurance company either. He made a decision based on what he thought was best for me at the time, and then got second guessed by the insurance company, and now I get to write out a big check. But you know, you don't have when you're being treated, and I would imagine if you're in a situation where it's a critical issue, you don't. There's no time then; it's too late.
Right, that's exactly right. When you're that sick that you're in the hospital, there's not a whole lot of discussion going on about how much it's going to cost and whether or not you really need it. So and I think this is a somewhat special case in the sense that the doctor made the decision not on the basis of how sick you were, but a matter of convenience.
Right.
So, you know, it's hard to know how common that
I'm not disputing the claim. I'm just paying it. But I was using it to illustrate. I mean, I didn't even think of it. And
right.
There I was being prepped for this procedure, and he just said, "Oh, well, we're going to do this." And it never even occurred to me at the time because I was more focused on other things.
And here's a question. Do we want our doctors thinking about how much something costs when they decide whether or not to give you a treatment? I think to some degree we don't. We want them to give you what the best treatment is. And that's I think that's something that we're going to have to work out in our system as we grope our way towards reform is to make physicians more conscious of cost may not be what we really want to do. What we want them to do is be conservative, give us the safest treatment, not give us treatment that's unnecessary, but not necessarily say, "No, we're not going to give you that because it costs too much." Now, he might have had the discussion with you about general anesthesia, which is more dangerous.
Well, yeah. Well, I signed a bunch of papers, and I knew the doctor very well, and he said, "This is what we should do." And I said, "Hey, you know, whatever you want. I'm among the few, the proud, the absurdly overinsured. My wife and I both have full coverage through our work, and I don't think about those things, but I probably should. It's probably a mistake on my part." Let's go back to the phones and take a call next from Diane in Sun Prairie. Diane, good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling about back surgery. It seems like so many people are having back surgery. They're having it 2-3 times. Do you think all of this back surgery is necessary?
Thank you for asking that question. That's a really interesting and important question. Back surgery is a very troubling area of medicine. There are a number of kinds of back surgery. And they are more or less invasive. So let's talk about one of them. There's something called spinal fusion. Now, spinal fusion is incredibly effective in certain kinds of back pain, pain from cancer, pain from certain kinds of malformations of the back, and it's a very effective treatment. But we really have no evidence that it's actually better than physical therapy or drugs or time in many other cases. Yet it's done very, very commonly, and many people who end up having back surgery end up having more than one fusion because they are left in just as much pain or worse pain. So what we really need to do is do a clinical trial, where you compare back surgery to less invasive treatments and find out who it really works for and how effective it really is. And we haven't done this. Back surgeons have been doing this surgery, this treatment, for 50 years, and we haven't actually done the clinical trials that are necessary to find that out. And I think the thing that surprised me the most in reporting this book was how little of medicine has really had the research to demonstrate whether or not it really works. And that just sort of stunned me as a medical reporter. I assumed that there was really good science behind what physicians were doing.
Let's take a call next from Steve, who's listening online in Houston, Texas. Steve, welcome to the broadcast.
Good morning. This is a great show. And thank you to your guest. And I just have to say, talking about that back surgery, I happen to have a friend down here in Texas who had a situation where she was experiencing a lot of problems in her back. And this was 15 years ago, they gave her that option of getting her spine fused. And they told her that, you know, she'd have to live with pain the rest of her life and all this and that, and she just decided that that wasn't the way she wanted to live her life, and she actually went to, this is a preface of what I want to say, to some naturopathic healers, some very good ones, and in the period of a year, they found parasites in her blood, which traditional Western medicine has a very hard time identifying, and was treated for, you know, pennies compared to what they wanted to charge her. It was like $50,000 surgery at the time, and lo and behold, she is, in fact, healed today. And I guess what I want to say is that we talk about fixing the problem. I think we really need brain surgery, and we're putting aspirin on the issue. And the issue, in fact, from what I can see, is that in most of the world, in Europe and in Asia, my wife is from the Orient, they, to this day, most of the medicine is an integration of Eastern and Western medicine, of the natural methods of healing in Europe. They have so many of naturopathic institutes are based in Austria, in Switzerland, in Germany, and in the Orient. I'm actually going to South Korea in 2 weeks for treatment for skin issues that I have, because I've had Western doctors tell me they can't find the problem. They can put chemicals on it, but that does not solve the problem. And I'm going there, and the treatment I'm getting is going to, in fact, cost a fraction of what it is here, and I can get treatment in some very excellent naturopathic methods. So it seems to me that if we want to solve the problem in America, we at a minimum have to force, and I think this is really the case, we have to demand that the FDA, which is basically in bed with the pharmaceutical industry, to open up and allow our insurance companies, our government, to acknowledge, respect, and help finance the proven methods of healing that the rest of the world acknowledges. And otherwise, you know, we're just going to be throwing, you know, billions of dollars at a system that is bankrupt. I mean, you have millions of people now that are flooding to other parts of the world, to Mexico, to Canada, to Europe, to Asia, for treatment that we can't get in America simply because the FDA won't allow it. You got people dying from liver failure from all these chemicals that they're putting
into Steve,
the blood.
We get it. We're running out of time, so okay. I want to make sure that we give our guest a chance to respond.
This is a really important issue that Steve has brought up. And I think that there's sort of two things going on here. One is that the body is this incredible mystery. We really, really don't understand our bodies very well. We think we live in the 21st century of medicine, but in fact, there are many mysteries out there. Number two, so to assume that we know the answers in Western medicine is probably arrogant. But number two, I agree that we need to look at these alternative treatments, but we need to scrutinize them in the same way that we scrutinize current Western medical practices. And we need to use science as the way of figuring out which ones of those alternative treatments really work and which ones don't. There's an old saying that I think dates back all the way to the 17th century, which is, God heals and the doctor sends the bill. And a great deal of disease goes away by itself over time. And if you have an intervention, whether it's alternative or Western, that happened somewhere in there and the body healed itself, it's the intervention that gets the credit. So what we want to know is what really works and what doesn't.
I got an email here from Rick in Madison. I want to make sure I get to this. As noted, current public policy is to have private drug companies pay for and do the research. They get the patent and profits. Has there been any research on the cost-benefit of the old way, where the National Institute of Health funded much more public research with benefits in the public domain, making the cost of the drugs closer to that of generics?
That's a really good question. It turns out that even now, the National Institutes of Health and publicly funded basic research is behind many of the drug breakthroughs that the pharmaceutical industry then is able to develop. I think we need a pharmaceutical industry. We need a robust pharmaceutical industry. Drugs are an essential part of treatment. But one of the problems is that we have left so much of the clinical research, the research that involves patients, to the drug industry, rather than publicly funding that kind of research as well as the basic research. So the problem is not so much that the NIH isn't doing the research anymore. It's that it's still doing the basic research. That's still being channeled into new drugs. But we are not doing the clinical research involving human patients using publicly funded money.
We just have a couple of minutes, and this question is probably going to take a lot longer than that to answer, but I want to get to it anyway. In about a minute or so, can you tell us what needs to happen to fix this problem?
Number one, we need this research, and it needs to be publicly funded, and we need to get going on that. We are 10 years behind the times on doing this research because of loss of funding about 12 years ago. Number two, we need to start finding a new way to pay for health care, and we need to pay for outcomes. We need to pay for efficient systems rather than simply paying for volume. One of the things I'd like to see happen is that we have more places like the Mayo Clinic, like Kaiser, like the Veterans Health Administration, which is one of the shining stars of American medicine right now. We have models out there, and we need to replicate those models all over the country. And there are certain aspects that they all have in common. And if we can get physicians and hospitals to start mimicking those models, we can have better health care, and we can bring down prices.
What about, is there some place people can go? Do you have a website or anything that you can refer us to for more information on what we're talking about?
Well, if you get the book, it'll give you some ideas. If you go to my website, www.overtreated.com, you'll have a few more ideas. But there are several websites out there that can also offer some information. One of them is the Cochrane Collaboration. That's Cochrane. And the Cochrane Collaboration does some of the kinds of research that's essential. But the single most important website to go to is the Dartmouth Atlas. It's www.dartmouthatlas.com. And it's full of really interesting statistics and information about your local area.
Shannon Brownlee, thank you for joining us this hour.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Shannon Brownlee, award-winning journalist and Schwartz Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C., and the author of the book Overtreated, Why Too Much Medicine is Making Us Sicker and Poorer, published by Bloomsbury. Carmen Jackson produced this hour with on-air production by Karen Prager. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine this week. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.